Hi everyone, my name is Mel Moore. I'm a medical oncologist at St Vincent's in Melbourne, and welcome to the next podcast in our series, Conversations in Lung Cancer Research. Before we start, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we live and work, and Toga pays their respect to elders past, present and emerging, and we extend that respect to all Indigenous people. Today, I am delighted to have a conversation with Professor Wendy Cooper. Wendy will be known to many in the Toga community, but we're hoping that this podcast goes far and wide. So I'm going to introduce Wendy before we start our chat. So Wendy is a senior staff specialist pathologist in tissue pathology and diagnostic oncology at the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital in Sydney. And she's also the anatomical pathology clinical stream lead for New South Wales Health Pathology. She has extensive experience in diagnostic and molecular pathology with a special interest in thoracic pathology. She's a member of the Pathology Committee of the International Association for the Study of Lung Cancer. She's a standing editor of the 6th edition of the WHO classification of tumours and a member of the expert panel for the International CAP IASLC AMP Lung Cancer Molecular Testing Guidelines. Wendy, welcome. Really delighted to speak to you today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Pleasure. Wendy, just going to start by getting a little bit of your background and your pathway to where you are today. I know certainly when I was a medical student, having a career in pathology probably wasn't on my radar, wasn't a specialty that I knew a lot about. Just for our listeners who aren't so familiar, could you just give us a bit of a rundown on how your career has progressed and how you've got here?
Yeah, sure. So pathology wasn't my first interest. My first interest was cancer. And that's what got me hooked as a medical student, hearing what cancer was. And when I first heard about the HeLa cell line, and we looked at them, it was actually in an infectious diseases tutorial. But I was fascinated that someone's cancer cells were still living in vitro from someone who died many years ago, and that these cells had the capacity to do that, to live on. And I was hooked on cancer from that point, and I considered, you know, several career options relating to cancer. But I started doing some research. I did a Bachelor of Medical Science where I did a project on breast cancer using breast cancer cell lines. And that involved pathology. And my co-supervisor was a pathologist. He was the head of Department of Anatomical Pathology at Royal Prince Alfred Hospital. And that's where I thought, oh, hang on, that's a pathway to cancer as well, where you get to study cancer a lot in the diagnostic workup. And I thought that that was very interesting. And I, you know, obviously consider other clinical specialties involving cancer, but I was more interested in the diagnosis rather than the management. So from there, it became a pretty easy decision to go into pathology. I liked the capacity to be able to make a diagnosis, but also integrate some research as well along the way.
And has all your training been through RPA, Wendy? Have you been across other hospitals or areas?
I have mostly been in Royal Prince Alfred, but I have worked in other areas as well. I did a little bit of hematology training as well, which I also liked. And I really liked in that you got to do both diagnosis and have the pathology lab side and some management as well. But I think my heart was always in solid cancers, solid tumours, and in pathology. I mean, I think it does take someone with a certain mindset who's happy to work in relative solitude, looking down a microscope or spending a lot of time looking down a microscope. I don't think everyone would be happy doing that, but it's also very collaborative, and we do interact with other colleagues within our department quite a lot, getting second opinions and so on. You know, people, there's kind of this, I guess, a cliche that pathologists aren't good communicators. I think a good pathologist is a very good communicator, and the aim is communicating with other medical specialists rather than with patients. We don't have direct patient contact. So there is a lot of that involved as well. There still is a lot of communication with other healthcare practitioners.
And I think especially with oncology, with the multidisciplinary team meetings, I mean, it's pretty common that all eyes swing to the pathologist hanging on your words of advice and diagnosis. And was lung cancer a deliberate choice, or was it serendipity, luck? How did you come to have the interest in lung cancer?
Yeah, serendipity for sure. I'd done some small research projects with people at Royal Prince Alfred in my first years of registrar training in the genetics department, and with Michael Millwood actually as well. And one of the scientists from the genetics department moved. This is Dr. Maya Kohonen-Karishu, who people may know. She moved over to the Garvan Institute and was supported by a grant, a philanthropic grant to study lung cancer. And I'd done some projects with her before. So she asked me to help in setting up a large cohort of lung cancer patients. I was just starting a PhD at the time, which was originally going to be in GIT tumors. And looking at this large cohort that Maya was setting up, and my supervisor at the time said, look, you're spending so much time on this lung cancer project. You know, why aren't you thinking about doing a lung cancer project rather? Why are you looking at this GIT thing? And it made sense. So I switched very quickly over to do a lung cancer PhD, and I loved it. And, you know, it was a really good time, I guess, to be getting into lung cancer as well. You know, in the early 2000s, there was a lot happening. You know, once you become embedded, I guess, into a particular tumor type, you get to know it in depth. And there's something fascinating, I think, in any tumor type. And I certainly haven't got bored from lung cancer.
So it sounds like, Wendy, early 2000s, things were just starting to really expand in lung cancer. I think I've read some commentary that you've done about when you first started in pathology, that it was a small cell or non-small cell, and we've come a long way since then. Could you have envisaged the changes that we've seen in lung cancer pathology over those years?
Yeah, no, not at all. Not at all. And you don't tend to look forward that much, I guess, either when you're starting out. I certainly, if you had asked me at the beginning of my training, did I think it would be possible that genetic testing of tumors would be embedded into everyday clinical practice? I would have said, I think that's too big a change. I can't see it getting done routinely. I think a lot of people would have said that at the time. So it's amazing how our mindsets can change. So at the time, it was very much morphology based. So, you know, what you saw down the microscope with very little, if any, immunohistochemical markers. So looking at the protein expression wasn't really part of routine diagnostics. And that has become more and more so, you know, same across other tumor types. And now, of course, routine molecular marker testing with genetic testing for specific somatic mutations as well is part of everyday practice. So, you know, that's revolutionized diagnostics in lung cancer for sure.
I'd imagine over that period, probably less so for yourself having done a research degree, but for pathologists in general, it'd be a fair bit of upskilling and getting familiar with new technologies. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, new technologies. And, you know, it's like anything, you don't have to be an expert of every little area, but you have to know what's needed and how to get it done, even if you're not the person doing it yourself. So I think there's been a lot of upskilling across pathology as a whole, not just in lung cancer, but in other tumor types as well. But, you know, perhaps lung cancer has been the poster child and had been at the forefront of that genetic biomarker revolution.
You mentioned that sort of when you're junior, you probably don't look forward that much, but I guess I'm going to ask you to look forward a little bit now. How do you see artificial intelligence and machine learning impacting on pathology and integrating with what pathologists do?
Yeah, I think like everything in medicine and a lot more broadly in our lives as well, that AI will undoubtedly have a role to play. I think we're really in our infancy of trying to figure out exactly what role AI will have in clinical practice. Some of the things that I've seen that it can do are, you know, very impressive, but what's actually safe and realistic in clinical practice is a very different thing. I think we'll undoubtedly have it within our laboratory information system. So that's, you know, the software we use to where we look at patients' past medical history and where we enter our reports and so on. We're seeing capacity for AI to assist in that. So elements where AI can help in bringing in relevant pieces of patients' medical history or can generate the staging of a cancer, for instance. If we put in the tumor size and this or that, then the stage could automatically be generated. So assisting in report generation, I think, will be very, very useful and make our lives quicker and more accurate. Everyone, when they think of AI and pathology, they think of machines reading the slides. I actually think that's a much higher bar and a much higher capacity of machines to be able to do that. It will happen. There are some commercial products available in other areas of pathology to assist in diagnostics. I'm quite sure it won't replace pathologists. I've got no worries that there will be jobs for pathologists, I see it as an augmentation and assistance of potentially some areas where pathologists may have higher chance of missing things, things that are a bit dull to go searching for, then AI assistants may help in that and produce a draft sort of report that a pathologist would then review and either agree with or disagree with or modify. So I'm sure we will see that over time and I look forward to it. I don't know how much of it will be in my lifetime. There's a lot of regulatory barriers and a lot of cost barriers. So I see it assisting in the software side before it becomes assisting in the diagnostic side. To be honest, I think that's a more realistic thing to achieve earlier.
Yeah, I mean, certainly challenges, but opportunities for all areas of medicine with AI. When you just want to change tack, so you were the recipient in 2023 of an IASLC lectureship award. Congratulations. And that was partly related to your involvement in translational research in lung cancer. What do you see as some of the exciting future directions for translational research in lung cancer?
Yeah, so I've been involved, like many people, I'm sure, in TOGA with ISLC for quite a number of years. And I've really loved the opportunity to collaborate and be a part of that organisation and to be able to get together with pathology colleagues, you know, amazing pathology colleagues in the lung cancer community from around the world. And I think together, by having an international group getting together, you can achieve so much more. You know, when you research yourself, just doing institutional studies or even multi-institutional studies within your state or your country, by having something international, you can really make a greater impact. So that's where I see the benefit there. What I see the opportunities being in the future, I think we need to have a more organized approach to biomarker assessment about whether they really are feasible for clinical practice and the best way to get them into clinical practice. So I think that we've learnt from the past about what works and what doesn't, and I think that will continue to evolve. And I see that as an important future area of research. And I think, as you said before, AI will continue to be a part of pathology research in particular over the coming decades.
So you mentioned the value of being involved with international organisations, both for the collegiality and the research opportunities. So for more junior pathologists or junior clinicians that may be listening to this, can you just outline how that initial involvement happened and what advice would you give to people that look at your career and think, oh, that's something I would like to emulate? How would they go about that?
Yeah, well, I did just that. I looked at other people and thought, I like the look of what they're doing. I'd love to have the opportunity to do similar things to them. So I had, you know, people I looked up to in the pathology world and the oncology community as well. But amongst pathologists, it was Doug Henderson from South Australia, Lindy Clark from Brisbane. They were both involved in ISLC pathology committee and met several others since then as well that I looked up to as well. And so I spoke to people and I asked them, I said, you know, how they got involved. Did they think it was a good thing? Did they think it was good value and so on, worthwhile? And I just started going to the conferences, the World Conference on Lung Cancer. So whenever opportunities arose to join a committee or program with the ISLC, I'd put my name forward and certainly wasn't successful at first, but I persevered and was fortunate enough to get onto the pathology committee. And once you've broken into, so to speak, the committee framework, many other opportunities open and you meet other people and have so many opportunities to be involved. So I really recommend people do that if they're interested in lung cancer or to follow those opportunities.
I'd imagine you're now in a position where people are contacting you for that similar advice of what to do and asking for your mentorship. Is that something that you enjoy doing, sort of, I guess, succession planning and bringing junior people through?
Oh, for sure. I think everyone, you know, it's really nice to, you know, to see your trainees come up through their training and come out as fully fledged specialists is something that's, you know, very lovely. I think everyone enjoys seeing that and seeing the careers that other people make. And, you know, I try to think of the good advice that I was fortunate enough to receive from other people and try and pass on those words of wisdom, any others that I can think of along the way as well.
Fantastic. Wendy, you've recently been an integral co-author on the molecular testing best practice publication, so molecular testing of lung cancer in Australia. Could you talk a little bit about how that came about and your involvement in that?
Yeah, look, a number of us have been saying for, you know, quite a few years really that we didn't really have our own Australian recommendations for molecular testing. We tended to follow the USA guidelines, which are from the College of American Pathology and the Association of Molecular Pathology in collaboration with ISLC. We tend to follow those guidelines, but they weren't, you know, really entirely fit for purpose for an Australian population, and now our unique, you know, funding environment that we're in that does, you know, play a crucial role in what treatments patients actually can access. And every now and then this would become an issue, and we'd, you know, whoever we were chatting with at the time would say, yeah, we really should have Australian recommendations. And the other reason that it's quite valuable is when we're trying to advocate for reimbursement for certain tests and treatments as well, if we can say, look, this is what we think is clinically appropriate. So after years of saying that we should do it, we were fortunate enough to receive funding from AstraZeneca to put together some guidelines. So they gave us a block grant that was, you know, completely independent of any input from them, which is why you want to do it. And then they gave the grant to the RCPA, the Royal College of Pathologists of Australasia. And from that, we put together a group of representatives from pathology and oncology community, a representative from each state. Bear in mind, there are many, many other people we could have invited as well. We had to limit the numbers, and we've come up with some, you know, I'm really happy with the outcome of those, some really robust recommendations on what we think is clinically appropriate for Australian patients. And it sets a standard for people to benchmark themselves against and to hold up to their administrators of their organisations and say, look, we're not meeting this if they're not. And also to the government as well, if there's some things that aren't funded that we think are really appropriate for an Australian population, we've got a statement there of say what we think is clinically appropriate.
And what were the main challenges during that process, or sort of key areas that you wanted to focus on?
Look, I guess it's quite complex, really. In some ways, we all think it's straightforward. We know that lung cancer needs molecular testing. But when you drill down into it, there is quite a lot of nuance in there. And there's quite a lot of different scenarios that you need to consider. And now, even though I guess most people are fairly familiar with first diagnosis, late stage disease, what testing to get done, there are many other scenarios that need to be considered, especially now that we've got emergence of targeted therapies and other therapies that are relevant in the adjuvant and neoadjuvant setting. So now we've really got to consider what biomarkers need to be done at that early stage disease. And there are also emerging biomarkers as well. So we're all familiar with the EGFR, ALK and ROS, but now, of course, there's many other markers. So it was trying to capture that quite rich tapestry of all different biomarkers that need to be tested at different stages, and what the best way to go about testing them from a pathology point of view is as well. So I think sometimes it's a bit lacking on the pathology side. So people know, yes, we need this marker, we need that marker. But what does that mean for a pathologist and for a pathology lab to make sure that that test is able to get done and to get done in the most appropriate way in order to optimise your chance of finding the relevant alteration that can be treated? So there were quite a few factors that we wanted to incorporate into that those recommendations, and I think we captured them all. It's an area that moves reasonably rapidly, so like anything, these will be out of date, you know, before long, and certainly they'll need to be revised over time as new evidence emerges, as it inevitably will.
So, and it just strikes me that as a thoracic pathologist in a big institution where this is your main focus, that might be quite a different experience to a pathologist that has a more general portfolio that is reporting a lot of different malignancies. I'd imagine there's quite a big education and information dissemination priority to ensure that all of this information is getting out to the people that need to know it.
Yeah, you're entirely right there. And that's one of the key things as well, is to try and make sure that everyone is as up to date as possible with the most relevant recommendations for our patients. And as you say, if you're a generalist, you can't know every little fine detail about every single specific tumour type. But at least if you know where to go, at least if you know the basics, at least if you know that, hang on, something is happening in the lung cancer space, not just an advanced stage disease, I better look that up, or something along those lines, or hang on, I seem to remember that there are more and more biomarkers now that are now relevant in lung cancer, let me go and check. And if we can at least have something there that's readily accessible for people who it isn't their main interest and don't see so many lung cancer cases, at least if it's at their fingertips and can easily find it, then I think we're going a long way to achieving appropriate testing for all our patients.
Yeah, and I think this document as you said, will go a long way to doing that if it's a good reference point for all of us in the lung cancer community. I guess that probably is a good segue into the concept of equity in access for patients with cancer. So these are increasingly complex and expensive testing regimens. There are things that are reimbursed on the MBS. There are things that are not. There are pathology departments that find workarounds. There are pathology departments that don't. How do you see us moving forward and ensuring that, you know, regardless of where you live, where you're from, that everyone has good, equitable access to good diagnostic testing, which, I mean, obviously then allows them to get the best treatments possible?
Yeah, I think it's a constant challenge in healthcare, and lung cancer is no different there in having these challenges. And I mean, I think the first step is being aware of them and being conscious of them and looking out for them. I think advocacy is really important, and that's where groups like TOGA are so important, and that we, united as a group, we're a much stronger voice than in a few little individual people speaking up from smaller centres. If we can see inequity and we can put that forward as an issue as a group, it's more likely to be heard. So I think that's a really important role for us. What other things can we do? Advocacy for funding is always important, and research into those areas, or, you know, trying to identify really what those differences in care are, to identify gaps and try and find ways to address them. It's so important. I think it's something that it's a responsibility for all of us. It's very easy to get, you know, attracted to, you know, the latest or greatest biomarker and trying to make sure that some patients access it. But really the greatest impact is trying to lift up everyone from the bottom up, and making sure no patient mixes out is often a way to make the greatest impact. So yeah, incredibly important.
Yeah, absolutely. Wendy, I mentioned multidisciplinary team meetings previously. Now, my experience of MDMs is that often it's quite straightforward. You've got a pathology, you've got your radiology patient in front of you, but There are times where I just feel like the weight of the world is on the pathologist, whether radiology might be discordant or it's a difficult case, and all eyes turn to the pathologist hanging on their every word to give a diagnosis, which may have quite marked implications on the treatment for that patient. Do you feel that weight of pressure? And if so, how do you handle that?
Right, maybe your MDMs are different to mine. I don't feel like everyone's waiting with bated breath for my results, but do I feel the weight of it? Look, I think sometimes yes. I mean, I think the important thing is to be honest, and when you're confident in a diagnosis, be confident. That's great. But when there's uncertainty, and this is something I say to my trainees, if there is uncertainty, if it's a biopsy that cannot reach a definitive diagnosis, it's important to be honest about that as well. And you can't be uncertain all the time. You've got to be certain when you can. When there's times where there's genuine uncertainty, it's important to convey that and to communicate that uncertainty so that an appropriate decision can be made about whether it's appropriate to just manage the patient with that uncertainty, or if greater certainty is needed, and if a repeat biopsy or so on is needed. So I'm not shy about saying when I think a biopsy is inadequate, or if I think a patient needs another biopsy. And I think that's something that comes with time and experience as well, of knowing when to be confident about a diagnosis and when to say this needs more sampling. And then it's easier, you know, you can sleep at night when you're passing on that honesty and sharing that uncertainty. I think that's doing the best by our patients.
Yeah, I probably made my MDMs sound more dramatic than they are, but most of the time it's smooth sailing. I'm just mindful that sometimes with challenging cases, there is that uncertainty. I always wonder whether the pathologists feel that weight of responsibility to give the answer. So no, you've answered that very well. Thanks, Wendy. I guess talking about access to tissue and repeat biopsy, it would be remiss of me to have a pathologist on a podcast and not talk about liquid biopsy and the role of liquid biopsy in diagnostics. What are your thoughts there, Wendy?
So in the role of looking for biomarkers, once a diagnosis is established, then I think there's certainly a role. I mean, ideally, the best scenario is to get the results from a tissue-based testing, because it's higher sensitivity and you're less likely to miss things. But of course, there's going to be times when that sample is inadequate and we can just make a diagnosis and we're confident to make that diagnosis, but there just isn't enough material to get full biomarker testing or sometimes any biomarker testing out of it. And in those situations, and I think there's definitely a role for liquid biopsy rather than putting a patient through repeat biopsy if it's not needed. And it's pretty easy to imagine that that's a more cost-effective way, is to do the testing on a blood-based sample rather than put a patient through a repeat biopsy. Having said that, there'll be times if that result comes out negative, you're still left with a little bit of uncertainty in that the rates of false negatives are higher in liquid-based samples rather than tissue-based samples. So if you find something, that's great. But if you don't find something, there's still that uncertainty and you may still need to consider repeat tissue biopsy if it's appropriate. And there's also a case to be made for if a patient's really critically unwell and you just cannot wait for biomarker testing through your standard referral pathways on tissue, getting it on liquid might be appropriate in some patients. So I think they're the two important roles for it currently. My concern is if we do get funding for those two scenarios, my concern is that every patient will be deemed critically unwell and everyone will want to get testing done. I think that's something that we need to think about and how to manage that, because we are, you know, resources are limited, are finite, and we do have to be responsible. We can't do liquid testing on every patient and tissue testing. I don't think that's appropriate. We need to be sensible about it. And then the other scenario potentially is if you're looking for specific resistance mutations in someone who has undergone targeted therapy, and if you're looking for a resistance mutation that can be found by liquid, so not all of them can, so a copy number variants amplifications are very hard to find on liquid, so that's not ideal. If you're looking for something that can be detected and can be treated, then there's a role for liquid biopsy in the resistance setting. We're not really there at the moment, but I envisage a future where that could be the case. But for upfront first diagnosis advanced stage disease, when there's insufficient tissue for biomarker testing, or if there's genuine urgency, then I think there's a role for liquid biopsies. And it's an area, as you know that there's not currently funding for that testing. And I hope that's a gap that we can fill in the future.
Yeah, no, definitely it would be great to have that option for patients. Wendy, you mentioned resourcing and you mentioned that there's now a role for molecular pathology in early lung cancer. We are all aware as well of the upcoming lung cancer screening program in Australia, which again, we hope we'll be sending more work your way to try and diagnose cancers at an early stage. Do you have any feelings from a resource and a workforce point of view, how that's potentially going to be affecting the world of pathologists?
Yeah, so I mean, like any screening program, you anticipate that there's more patients shifted to diagnosis at early stage disease, so there'll be resectable disease. So we should be seeing more surgical specimens, which is great to see patients treated with curative intent by downstaging. So that will be great. And that will have some impact on pathology. I don't imagine it will be huge because there's still going to be low numbers that are ultimately diagnosed with cancer. I'm a bit more concerned about the workload that there'll be with nodule management, MDTs, and even though the screening program guidelines for how to manage nodules and follow-up CTs and so on are very clear, I suspect in the real world there'll be patients and clinicians who want a biopsy before perhaps it's indicated, and that we'll see a lot more biopsies of things before they're, you know, clinically detectable and so on, and so that will put more work on pathologists and the MDTs resulting from those kind of interventions. I think it's something in Australia, we probably in other countries as well, where we haven't really got resourcing for MDTs figured out properly, to put it mildly. And all of us are putting in an awful lot of time into MDTs compared to 10, 20 years ago, and we're not resourced for that. We all recognise that they're of value, but we haven't found a way to manage the resourcing for those. And that's something that I think we needs dealing with in the future as well.
And that comes into equity as well, doesn't it, of having everyone's case an opportunity to be discussed at an MDT.
Absolutely. And there's vast differences in which patients do or don't get discussed at MDT in different centres.
Yeah, very much so, unfortunately. Yeah. We're almost at the end of our discussion. Is there anything that I haven't raised or asked that that you feel is a burning topic that you'd like to comment on? Any final comments?
I'll just say one thing, because I sort of wanted to say it before but missed the chance. I heard on a podcast recently someone had been given advice when they were younger, that and the advice was, before you're 40, say yes to everything, and after you're 40, say no to everything. And I certainly had received the specific advice to say yes to everything, was advice I was given when I was younger. And I think that is good advice. But then when you do get older, there comes a time when I don't think you stop suddenly at 40, that's for sure. But then you start to get a little bit choosy as you get older. But for when you're younger, say yes to everything, I think is really good advice.
Yeah, I'd absolutely agree with that. There is a different transition point for everybody where that tips the other way. But I think you've got to be involved in things to get your name and your person out there, and can lead to some amazing experiences.
Yeah, and find what you like and what your strengths are and what's not such a great fit for you. That's the time to discover it.
Yeah, no, great advice, Wendy. Wendy, it's been an absolute pleasure having a discussion with you today, and this is going to be of great interest and benefit to our listeners. As always, to our listeners, thanks for listening to TOGA's Conversations in Lung Cancer Research. If you enjoy our show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen to your podcasts.